You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, Rhyme or Reason, a guided tour of the hidden kingdom of clinical reasoning, presented by Dr. Simon Morgan and Dr. Jess Wrigley. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
I warmly welcome you to this topic that I must say I'm very, very passionate about and very interested in and always really excited to talk about. I reflect on the fact that as a medical student, way back now at University of Sydney and as a GP trainee in New South Wales in Sydney, I'm pretty confident that the term clinical reasoning really wasn't mentioned. Maybe it was, maybe I missed it, but for something that is so fundamental to what we do as GPs, really is in essence everything we do as GPs comes down to effective clinical reasoning. It really only has become prominent as a concept that we talk about, that we teach, that we learn quite recently. So for something that is so base in what we do as GPs every day, it's really only started to become pretty prominent in GP training. So it's very exciting to be talking about it because it's something that I think is just so, so fascinating and interesting and such a rich area to explore with registrars. And this is a bit of a guide through the hidden kingdom, maybe for some of you familiar territory, for some of you quite unfamiliar. So we'll be talking about a language, we'll be talking about a bit of a map and getting a bit of a sense of what reasoning really is. There's going to be a little bit of conceptual stuff here, but of course, this is based absolutely in what we do every day as GPs. So I don't want to move too far away from the consulting room. And let's start with Ben. And Ben's a 55-year-old man. And you open up your best practice or whatever software you use, appointment book, and see that the receptionist has helpfully put the word cough in for the reason he's presenting. Now, obviously, it would be preposterous to ask you to diagnose Ben from this point, but already I know your reasoning processes are kicking in. You're thinking about epidemiology. You're thinking about seasons and your location and your availability of recent diagnosis and all the sorts of things that we do as GPs, narrowing down already a differential for Ben, who's a 55-year-old man with a cough. We'll come back to Ben because I want to just cover broadly what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about reasoning, this wonderfully rich area of practice, clinical reasoning, and make a distinction between diagnostic and management reasoning. The other thing that's emerged even more recently than clinical reasoning as a concept is management reasoning. We talk about diagnostic reasoning all the time, how we make diagnoses. But this notion of management reasoning is even more recent still. We'll talk a bit about biases. And I guess you're all here because you're supervisors and you're interested to know how you can reason better as clinicians, but how you can assess and teach this stuff in your registrars. And I'll endeavour to make this as practical as possible in that regard. We commonly, the evidence would say in 50% of occasions, we can't ascribe a diagnostic label to patients when they present with an undifferentiated problem, but we certainly do our best to come up with the best plan. And so what is clinical reasoning? When we think about unpacking it, what is it in our practice as GPs? What does the literature say? And there are all these elements. It's gathering data and gathering data effectively. It's weighing it up, synthesizing it, interpreting it. It's communication with the patient back and forth. It's involving the patient in the decision and the process of care. It's managing uncertainty. Louise Stone, many of you know Louise as a very prominent GP academic who talks about GPs as swamp warriors. We get down and dirty in the muck and the murk of the swamp while our specialist colleagues look down from their high, sunny ground, watching us sort of neck deep in the mud. That's general practice, and that's why we're so good at what we do. And incorporation of evidence. And, you know, in a sense, that's kind of the bowl, the mortar and the pestle. It sort of gives that sense of combining it, weighing it up, and coming up with something that we can make sense of. So back to Ben, who we introduced. He's got a cough. Now, a little bit more data. There's Ben. He comes down the corridor and sits down with you, and he gives you a bit more history. And, of course, this is what we do every day. And I'm not in any sense trying to sort of unpack this to the nth degree, but just to say, of course, this is how we narrow, this is how we kind of, if you imagine a tree and the diagnosis maybe is a leaf at the end of a twig at the end of a branch, we're kind of working, trying to work out which of those branches we follow. 5 weeks of cough, non-productive, no chest pain. And he says, I've had asthma, but not since I was a kid. How does that influence your diagnosis? What maybe is the most likely diagnosis now? We're not going to, and the point isn't that we actually diagnose Ben here and we talk about management. It's just starting to kind of interrogate, unpack your thinking. And so much of clinical reasoning, teaching and assessment is trying to kind of get inside your own head and see those processes to be able to then articulate them to the registrars. So any refinement on diagnoses?
Yeah, so we've had three or four brave people now. So two have said post-viral cough and two more in that obstructive type, you know, disease thing, one COPD, one viral-induced asthma. Oh, and one who said gastroesophageal reflux disease.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. All right, well, we'll be coming back to Ben, but just before we revisit his history, he does give you a little bit more history, actually. He's an ex-smoker. Quit 4 years ago, and he's got a long history of smoking. Can see a kind of differential shuffling around on your mental whiteboard here. Now, this is not so much probably influencing your diagnosis, but maybe the management script, the management reasoning we talk about, maybe it doesn't, but he's a lawyer and he says, I'm worried I have lung cancer. And as we talked about, diagnostic reasoning and management reasoning all combined to this sort of broader concept of clinical reasoning. And so there are very important elements of what we uncover that may influence the way we manage a patient. The processes here is pattern recognition. You're seeing a pattern, you're interrogating your mental filing cabinet and coming up with something. Now, of course, no one would be diagnosing this patient or making some sort of judgment of importance based on this little bit of data. So we have to collect more data, clearly. And so you're already kind of categorizing and then thinking, which additional questions or bits of data do I need to pursue? But just how we can go from one little bit of data and how we can potentially pattern recognize and come up with what we think is going on, or otherwise go in a bit more laborious way to try to work it out from first principles. To introduce a concept which I think many of you will be familiar with, of so-called type 1 versus type 2 thinking, or non-analytical versus analytical thinking. So this type 1 thinking is pattern recognition. It's this very rapid, intuitive, efficient processes that we all go through as more and more experience we get. We interrogate our mental library. As we become experts, we're much, much more familiar with the whole bunch of patterns. And it is actually really hard to articulate often what we see. Heuristics are those rules of thumb. When I see this, I think this, and it's kind of held me in good stead over the course of my career. The point is that nobody needs to do the maths. We all have the timetables in our heads because it's drummed into us. It's pattern recognition. A 25-year-old man who develops a patch on his belly and then over a few days gets this more widespread, slightly itchy rash over his trunk, consistent with pityriasis rosea. A 35-year-old woman with sweats, weight loss and palpitations. John Murtagh's triad, that's the classic presentation of hyperthyroidism. But hopefully some of you are also thinking, but wait, is this something more sinister? Is this a lymphoma or a travel-related infection or some other cause going on here? We're talking about pattern recognition. We're talking about this very rapid, intuitive thinking. And, of course, some things are spot diagnoses. Yep, that's what it is. And other things just require a little bit more of a story to make the diagnosis. And these are our so-called illness scripts. There are a bit of a constellation of pathophysiology, epidemiology, of the symptoms and signs. These sort of illness scripts that we are allowed to actually question. And lastly, I talked about management scripts. And interestingly, these have become a lot more kind of talked about in the literature. And these are the equivalent of an illness script, a diagnostic script, but they're a bunch of management concepts because essentially this is the KFP. This is how registrars pass their KFP exam, by thinking when, you know, what are the broad aspects of management in this patient? The management script entails these types of aspects of care. What I'm presenting to you is stuff that is all there, it's all filed, it's all neatly stored away, and you can interrogate that as you become more and more expert and produce that, compared to so-called type two thinking, which is this much more medical student, laborious, you know, deliberate, take a bit more history, examine the patient, get them back, do some tests, get them back, send them off to the specialist, that very kind of deliberate thinking that we have to use when we're not familiar or it's a tricky presentation. And this is very much the domain of, if anyone watches House, Noah is an expert diagnostician. He has a whiteboard, he writes stuff up. But House epitomizes this very sort of hypothetico-deductive process. Hopefully, engaging way of talking about this so-called dual model of cognition, where, but almost essential, I reckon, for registrars to know how they think, to know how they reason when they see patients. And the more expert we get, the more non-analytical, the more pattern recognition we employ when we see patients.
I would hope as well, Simon, sorry, also able to know when is the appropriate situation to become more analytical.
There's a very well-established cognitive bias called premature closure, which is where registrars, and we see it when we do teaching visits, they kind of close things off pretty quickly. And I think as educators, as supervisors, we do see this commonly, just to say, well, you know, maybe you're falling into the trap of pattern recognizing a bit too quickly. And you do need to step back and at least take a bit more history or pose a few questions that might counter the diagnosis. So cognitive biases, and we are all guilty of cognitive biases all the time, as is our registrars. The evidence around trying to identify them and trying to address them in real time is actually really scant. It's actually quite a hard thing to do, but I think it is worth at least knowing and trying to get a sense of when we might fall foul of these things. Tim, a four-year-old boy, presents with a cough for a couple of days. It's winter. There's been lots and lots of colds. It's very easy, of course, in that context. I mean, our availability bias of lots of upper respiratory tract infections leads us to maybe not take the history sufficiently well to diagnose that this kid's got pertussis. Yanni, a 46-year-old man, has got PR bleeding and a change in his bowel habit, but he had a colonoscopy 15 months ago. So is that sufficiently reassuring for us? This is anchoring bias. We anchor on a bit of history, on a bit of information that means, I don't think we need to worry too much. But really, those symptoms are potentially quite concerning despite this otherwise reassuring bit of information. So we can anchor our thinking on something that may push us away. And the classic is, you know, somebody with chest pain that maybe has some relationship to food, and we kind of seize on that and perhaps miss an NMI. Lastly, this is an example of self-labeling. So patients very commonly tell us what they think's going on, which can be hugely beneficial if we hadn't thought of it. And of course, really helpful to know what they're concerned about so we can address it. But actually can be very misleading if it leads us not to pursue something we might have. So here's Zoe, a 28-year-old woman who says, I think I've been on a UTI, and she's got dysuria and pelvic pain. And probably the classic cognitive bias that we often talk to registrars about is this patient presentation where we miss the newly acquired chlamydia because she's self-labeled and maybe she doesn't have or she's got symptoms that are more suggestive of a urinary cause. But there are other biases at play here. How does that influence our diagnostic reasoning and potentially our management reasoning when the patient's a colleague? So I'll be referring to the GPSA Clinical Reasoning Guide. And it does include a description of lots of the cognitive biases that occur commonly in practice. We can admit very freely and very comfortably to our registrars that we all do this all the time. I was talking to a supervisor today from Western Australia about challenging patients. And he was saying he used to call the talk difficult patients, but that sounded a little bit pejorative, which I thought was a bit tough. And I said to him, well, they used to be called in the literature, the hateful patient, which we know there are patients that we find hard work or heart sinks, and we know there are patients who we like and we really enjoy seeing them. How does that influence potentially the way we reason?
Yeah, so someone had asked earlier, is type 1 thinking heuristics, which I think you did sort of address a little bit, but they followed up with a question about heuristics asking, you know, are they a negative thing or is it that it could be problematic when used by novices?
Fantastic question. They're incredibly useful. They make us who we are. They make us efficient, skilled practitioners. And of course, we wouldn't and couldn't practice like we do without heuristics, without rules of thumb, without pattern recognition and spot diagnoses and making and mental shortcuts. And shortcuts sounds kind of like bad, but it's what we do. And I think most of us do it safely because we look for red flags, we kind of use a few other things we'll talk about to reason, and that's how we practice efficiently. But of course, it can lead us astray. And I guess the point of this is, yeah, if you're observing maybe they're falling into pattern recognition and those sort of more swift ways of thinking too early, it can be problematic because, you know, if you can think of your brain as being this huge filing cabinet full of patients and you've cleverly filed them all away and they're all categorized. And so when you see someone, you know where to thumb, but the registrars clearly have far, far, far fewer patients filed away for them to rely on. You examine Ben, he's got some fine basal crepitations. That's a surprise. And the chest x-ray shows some reticular changes more pronounced at bases. And Ben has pulmonary fibrosis, possibly not something that any of you put down at the start, but that is not in any way to say that you wouldn't have got there at the end, just to say that this was a bit more of a hypothetico-deductive process to get there. Let's talk a little bit about why you're here. How can registrars develop their clinical reasoning skills? How can they improve what they do? There is an exam in the RACGP called the KFP. I'm sure you all know of it, Key Feature Problem Paper, and it is an assessment, it is the assessment as such of clinical reasoning, that without a base of knowledge, you can't reason or you can't reason effectively. So the first way, and in fact, the only way a registrar can develop reasoning is to have knowledge. And that means they need to read and they need to see patients. There's no shortcuts in that regard. The next kind of level is that sort of organization. So building the illness script. And I guess that's very much around seeing patients, talking about cases, getting a sense of when things occur, when they don't occur. The next level ups, you know, these approach to reasoning with fast and slow thinking. And the last one is metacognition. That's that very kind of sophisticated level of thinking where you are actually thinking about your thinking. You're actually almost above yourself, observing how you're thinking and observing how you're processing information. And that is sort of regarded as the sort of the upper level of reasoning. So there's no sort of secrets here. And for a registrar, this is, oh my goodness, really? And it is, yeah, I'm sorry. You're just going to have to read a bunch of stuff, commit a lot of it to memory and put it into that library of patients by seeing lots of patients, having a broad clinical exposure and case discussion. And that's the role that you have so, so fundamentally as a supervisor, is to talk about cases, to talk about classic cases, talk about atypical cases that you've seen over the years of myocardial infarction. Talk about, you know, a simulated case. Let's role play somebody coming with maybe a slightly unusual presentation. Observing a registrar, being available for their problem case discussion at the end of the Thursday afternoon, and doing random case analysis as frequently as you can to really, really interrogate their thinking and develop their reasoning.
A comment which was, I find metacognition happens best when I'm discussing a case out loud with my colleagues in the tea room.
Thinking out loud is one of the key things we encourage registrars to do.
RCA type discussion where, you know, changing one thing in the presentation when discussing the case. You know, for example, what if the patient were 50 rather than 20, you know?
Yep.
Ask the GP registrar about hypothesis-directed questioning. Always list a few differentials, even if the diagnosis seems obvious, to try and combat premature closure in case discussions. I remember when I was studying for my KFP, in all my patient notes, I forced myself to do that. Impression this and then put three different differential diagnoses, and I think that's a good way to ensure you're always thinking broadly, even if it seems really obvious. Direct observation both ways. Random case analysis both ways. Oh, I like that. So for the supervisor as well. Inbox review, pre-consultation, preparation, and not writing notes, just listening to the patient and getting the vibe before sort of attention to the computer.
It's we'll interesting you talk about writing differentials, Jess, and forcing questions that refute the diagnosis. I just need to think of something that if they say, oh, no, I don't have that, you're going to go, oh, well, maybe that changes things. The other thing I would encourage, and it's in the same vein as putting down a differential in the notes, is using even an autofill or certainly trying to force that management script into the notes as well. And that would really encourage a registrar to think broadly about the options for management rather than this medication or physio review, but thinking, well, are there public health implications? What safety netting do I need to do? You know, what educational resources might I be able to give the patient? Are there medication options? So, you know, it's as basic as take a good history and examine the patient. And I know that sounds so basic. Why am I including it? But of course, as supervisors, as educators, we so commonly see that not the case. And we're not talking about medical student exhaustive histories. We're talking about identifying key features, excluding red flags, those really prominent aspects that might help differentiate. There's a really lovely paper, but can I encourage you, if you haven't come across this paper by Paul Glasziou, who many of you all know is a champion of evidence-based medicine up in Brisbane, wrote in the BMJ, it's just a beautiful paper, 3 pages long, and it talks about diagnostic strategies in general practice. And it talks about these 3 stages, initiation, refinement, and defining the final diagnosis, and talks about these elements as we go. We're talking about diagnostic reasoning when we talk about John Murtagh's prompt model for something that was a kind of homespun, born from years and years and years working in rural general practice in Victoria. This model has become sort of internationally regarded and clearly the basis for many registrars' preparation for exams and clinical practice. Probability, what's it likely to be, what can't I afford to miss, red flags, what are the masquerades, and very nicely, the ICE questions, ideas, concerns, expectations, what's the patient actually telling me, and his 7 masquerades, which I think at times are a bit of a long bow, but, you know, there's some merit in many cases. Diagnostic pause and management pause, because essentially this is just a pause. And this is a strategy that I think many of us do and do effectively, but I think many registrars sort of find a bit challenging to actually carve out 10 or 15 or 20 or 30 seconds out of the consultation and just say, do you mind just sitting tight? I'm just going to have a bit of a think about what's going on, maybe make a note or two, and then I'll come back to you. Do you mind just sitting quietly for a sec or putting the blood pressure on them? And I'm just going to, you know, work out what the best strategy is, and we can have a yarn about what I'm thinking. Just making that diagnostic or management gap in the consultation rather than feeling you've just got to keep moving forward and, you know, the kids are upending the bin and there's a baby crying in the treatment room and it's just that sort of mayhem, and just saying, even leaving the room and looking something up or getting them to do a urine test and having that little bit of time thinking aloud. So articulating. So I've taken your history and I've examined you. And there's a number of things I'm thinking here. To be honest, I'm not entirely sure what's going on, but, you know, off the range of things this could be, I'm reasonably confident it's nothing too serious. It could be this because of this and this and this, but it's less likely to be these things. So not only are you talking out aloud, you're reasoning as you're talking, but giving the patient your own sort of unpacking your thinking. And again, I think registrars can be quite sort of confronted by that. It's almost like it's got to be a bit of a performance. They've got to take it in, weigh it up, synthesize it, and produce this lovely little spiel. Whereas, you know, I think the more experienced we are, the more we're happy to share where our thinking's going, certainly our uncertainty, and include the patient in it all.
I was going to say, I think that does tie in with the level of comfort with uncertainty and kind of owning the uncertainty and sharing that with the patient.
It's all about the way we discuss with patients, and that's why communication is so much part of reasoning. Rational use of tests. Clearly, tests are incredibly helpful to inform diagnostic reasoning and management reasoning, but they can be incredibly destructive to those things as well when they're not done rationally, if we're chasing false positives or, you know, swayed by results that were unhelpful and we didn't need to know. Seeking help. So this is just about your accessibility, availability as a supervisor for registrars to go, well, I'm a bit stuck. I need to have a yarn to you. And we'll talk in a second about what you can do in that way, because it's not just, yeah, I reckon you're on track, do this. It's about assessing and teaching reasoning as you go. Checklists, we shun perhaps a little bit as clinicians, as GPs. Pilots use them, surgeons use them, operating staff, obviously, and nuclear power plant technicians. But, you know, the thought of pulling out a checklist or a list of possible diagnoses because somebody's got hard to explain dyspnea seems really, you know what, that would be really uncomfortable, but in a sense, why not? Or at least why not after the patient's gone or with the patient in a way that makes them feel comfortable. We talked about gut feelings a little bit, that sense of alarm or sense of reassurance, and how powerful that can be as a clinical reasoning tool to say, you know, even though you're not well and still not quite right, I don't know, I feel okay about that, there's nothing sinister going on. I feel like, and obviously sharing this with the patient, as opposed to, look, even though the tests are normal, I'm quite worried about what's going on. I think we need to do something else. So that gut feeling and how that can guide often our management reasoning. And, of course, safety netting, and that's our backstop, certainly as part of management reasoning.
Yeah, before you move on, there were two comments, one about thinking out loud and one supervisor saying that they found it to be really helpful to demonstrate the thinking out loud when the registrar is sitting in with you and makes them realise. Well, firstly, I guess it gives them permission to do it, but you know, makes them realise how hard you have to work in sort of going through the process. And someone's asked a much more existential question, that can we be replaced by AI? The guys on I Am Reasoning, I think it was, talked to, I think it was Gurpreet Dhaliwal, about AI, and their summation was that doctors won't be replaced by AI, but doctors that don't use AI will be replaced by doctors that do use AI, was the way that they presented the way AI will work in medicine.
Well, I think you've answered that far better than I could have. And I think you've also gone to a very authoritative source. For those of you who don't know I Am Reasoning podcast, Jess is referring to a wonderful podcast series by a couple of Northern American, New Zealand-based internal medicine physicians who unpack reasoning, diagnostic dilemmas with great humour and certainly extremely good competence. So I talked about how can a registrar develop their reasoning strategies, and disappointing news, guys, sorry, you're going to have to read, you're going to have to acquire that knowledge, you're going to have a really, really nice firm base at the bottom of that triangle before you can start to build your illness scripts, which happens by seeing a bunch of patients and talking about a bunch of cases. What strategies do we use? We've just talked about a whole range of those. And of course, they're all things we use to make us better clinicians. And they're also things we can model and we can teach. And there's a few last things in terms of teaching strategies. And these are endeavored to kind of take you on a little bit of a tour into the hidden kingdom of clinical reasoning. As part of that, a bit of history, a bit of geography, a bit of vocabulary. And so using that, I think talking about biases and talking about dual process thinking and talking about reasoning strategies and saying, you know, I'm keen to assess your reasoning. I want to make a judgment on how well you're reasoning. I'm asking these questions because it's so important for me to have a handle on how well you're reasoning and for your reasoning to develop. In the clinical reasoning guide, there's a whole raft of questions that are very much around the sorts of things you'll be asking anyway, but linking them to reasoning, making that sort of clear to the registrar can be really valuable. Things like, how important is this little bit of data? Does it change the way you think? What's more important or less important? Is there a pattern in what you're seeing? Those sorts of questions can be really useful. Problem representation is a wonderfully succinct summary at the beginning of a case presentation. If you as supervisors encourage your registrars to present every case in a problem representation format, I'd like to ask you about a 32-year-old school teacher who presents with a three-week history of worsening right shoulder pain and on, talking about red flags, talking about relevant negatives. In that way, their reasoning will improve. Of course, it'll really help you, and that will set things up for an assessment of reasoning, including, you know, if you're going to use a model like we talked about recently, that's the first part of a sort of case discussion. Script sorting, I referred to a bit ago. I think this is a potentially really valuable teaching tool for supervisors and registrars. And that's where you just get a grid. I mean, you can do it on a scrap of paper in the tea room. And on one side, you put a bunch of diagnoses. And on the top, you put a bunch of symptoms. And then with your registrar, you rank how common things occur. So we know vomiting. Does vomiting occur in stroke? I guess it can, but it's pretty common or much more likely in labyrinthitis, say. BPPV0, I don't know, I think probably people do vomit with that. But this sort of exercise, registrars studying together, learning in the practice setting, I think could be something that you'd really enjoy. And that would really, really help, I think, assess and unpack reasoning in your registrar. I just want to talk about a couple of resources. The first one is a thing called How to Assess and Teach Clinical Reasoning. And I'm not going to go into it in any more depth except to say it exists. GPSA has developed a new suite of resources called the How To Guides. There's one on how to do problem case discussion, how to do random case analysis, and how to assess and teach clinical reasoning. And it really just summarizes lots of the things we've talked about with a little bit of a framework. Again, case presentation, probe for further information, maybe pose for hypotheticals, ask some what ifs, clarify the problem, and then prioritize what to do. The clinical reasoning game, which I know many of you have been really interested in and probably have used over the years as a hard copy resource, is now online. And for those of you who don't know how it works, you get a couple of random cards and you flip the demographics card, you flip the presenting complaint, and you end up with completely randomly a 62-year-old female with weight loss and think, all right, well, what's your differential? And the registrar, you know, has to think as broadly as they can, and they can use a range of different models. Now, I think the value is in just generating a differential. If you want to use prompt versus the anatomic versus the surgical sieve model, be my guest. So spinning the wheel, I think, is just a bit of an extra, but really it's about generating a differential. And then you turn another card up, so a physical examination card, they're pale. How does that rule in or make more significant some diagnoses or rule others out? And then lastly, a findings or results, and they've got poor dentition. And of course, this narrows down the differential and you play more cards and more cards. And it's been a really quite fun game that I know many supervisors have used. And if you haven't with your registrar, I'd certainly give it a go now that it's back accessible and this time online. We've referred to the guides, the Clinical Reasoning Guide, the Managing Uncertainty Guide, I Am Reasoning podcasts, and the Society for Improving Diagnosis in Medicine, which is around diagnostic error, but also clinical reasoning, have a very good resource library on their website with some non-medical text. And many of you I know will go, I know that book, or I've read that book, Daniel Kahneman, who wrote about thinking fast and slow. That is nothing to do with general practice. Well, it's probably everything to do with general practice, but it's in the lay context. And also a nice book called How Doctors Think, which you might be interested to read. Turn clinical reasoning into clinical seasoning. And I know there's a bit of a pun, but I like the notion of gathering a bowl of data, weighing it frequently, mixing it well with a pinch of uncertainty, a little bit of ice just to cool the mixture down. Pause for a spell, combine with a tablespoon of evidence, and serve with an offer of seconds. And hopefully in that way you will reason well and your registrars will similarly. Jess, any other comments, questions?
There was one about research on how one develops gut feelings, but that might be something, I don't know if you have anything to direct people to on that offhand.
But there is a literature on it. Of course, it's a pretty tough thing to measure and to assess and to work out. But yep, there is. And it's really interesting stuff to read about.
And there was someone else asking, do you feel it's appropriate advice to suggest registrars need to see more patients rather than go home to study in preparation for exams as well as for their professional development? But
And I guess it's that sweet spot, isn't it, of not hammering them too much and not having time to read. But, you know, many registrars say to us, I'm thinking of going part-time so I can study half the week. And we think, well, that's fine if you need the time because you've got young kids or another responsibility and commitment. But cutting clinical exposure down just to read isn't going to help develop your reasoning if you're needing to build those illness scripts. So, it's a balance, I guess. I invite you to our community platform if you haven't already joined. Thank you, thank you, thank you. We hope you've enjoyed this. I hope that's been interesting and has inspired you. Enjoy teaching your registrars about reasoning.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.